Blog Talk Radio.
Kindergarten. I'd go with my dad. A lot of my dad's career was here in the South. I mean, as far as the Memphis territory, which would be Memphis, Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee, Louisville, Kentucky, Evansville, Indiana, Lexington, Kentucky, and then spot shows around on days. So, like on our TV show in those days, which like it went through the years, start was on Saturday morning at 11 o'clock. It was from 11 to 12:30. So then the big show for me would be on Monday night. My dad would carry me with him to the Mid-South Coliseum. That was kind of a cool deal. I mean, like I said, we all looked up to different people, and I looked up to wrestlers pretty much my whole life.
Okay, when you were a kid, how much did you know about the actual business behind wrestling?
I was one of the few kids, but I guess it was because I was from here and from this territory, and I knew all the guys from like Jerry to Jerry Lawler from when I was, like I said, 4 or 5 years old. So, I mean, everybody I was around, and I mean, as far as going in the back and in the dressing rooms, and I remember like some of the guys every once in a while, like all the guys that would come from off that didn't know me, they'd look or something and wait a second, they might get quiet for a second, and they'd say, well, after a little while, they'd realize, well, he's just kind of one of the guys too. But I was just kind of I remember when I was a kid before Sam Bass got killed in the tragic car accident that they burned up in. He'd used to give me money every week to go get him Cokes, and he'd tell me to get me a Coke and a candy bar, but I was just kind of like one of the guys. I was just the young kid there.
All right. Do you know, did you always plan on being a wrestler?
Yeah, I think from since when I was a kid and watched, and I used to go with my dad, and then, like I said, my brother's right at 10 years older than I was, so he got in the business about 10 years before I did, and everything. Then, you know, when he got in the business and I started getting to go with him, I went with him on a summer he worked the Kansas City territory, and I went out there for like a month and a half when I was out of school one summer, and that was really cool. Him and Ricky Morton was partners, and that was kind of always, like I said, I got to hang around a good bunch of guys back when wrestling was really wrestling. I'd say it's not today. It's just things have changed so much.
Yeah. I was noticing that because I was doing research last night. I noticed that your brother, Eddie, he was a bit older than you. What was your relationship like with him when you were a kid?
It was as much like, I mean, I was always, I mean, my brother always took care of me, and I will always be grateful for that. Me and him, he's probably my best friend in the world as far as the wrestling business and everything. But, I mean, my brother was so much, I mean, a lot of people didn't get to know him. He was so much before his time. I'm saying, like, when I was a kid in school, I just wanted to be a wrestler. My brother wanted to book. I mean, he wanted to be a great wrestler, but he actually wanted to book. He'd sit and he'd write down cards, you know, like his notebooks and his pads and stuff, and go back to the day, and I can look at them, and it's just amazing. I mean, Eddie was way before his time.
Yeah, you know, I was telling a friend of that because I was watching some Continental Wrestling from '88, and I was telling a friend of mine how far ahead of its time it was.
Right. I mean, you know what? What's funny is I remember guys in the territories and that I worked for Eddie Ed and the other guys worked down there and say, well, do you think this is going to work? Or they, you know, some which they'd never say it to Eddie. People would say stuff to me, and they knew, you know, I wasn't going to say nothing. I mean, unless it really needed to be said and everything. And I'd say, yeah, it's going to work. I'd say Eddie's got, I mean, he's got a vision for the way he wants it to go and what the outcome of it, he wants it to be. It wouldn't just be like he was going through this show to get to the next show, you know. I mean, he always had everything laid out. And, you know, some people say, oh, you can't do that, you got to change. But, I mean, Eddie always had the feel of the people, and that was hard for a lot of people, you know, to ever grasp or to ever get and understand.
Now, what was your first job in wrestling as far as, like, actual being a wrestler?
I went to, same as my dad and my brother, I went to Malden, Missouri when I was a senior in high school, and I wrestled over there for a guy named Henry Rogers, which is, so did, like, Wayne Ferris, Honky Tonk Man, Larry Latham, which guys that you have probably heard of before, the Moondog Spot. And, I mean, there was a whole lot of us that went over there. I was just one of the latter ones that went when he still actually run a show and everything. I did that. And I worked a couple times against Lawler, like on TV, before I even started, like under a hood and different things like that. But that was kind of the first steps, I think.
How was it when you first worked with Jerry Lawler? Did it meet your expectations, or was it disappointing?
Well, you can imagine. Lawler's always been great to my family and myself, and which we've all had some differences, probably more me than with him than my brother and my dad. But, I mean, still, he's always been real good to me and stuff. But you can imagine what the as far as growing up as a kid watching, and you being 17 years old in high school, and I'm telling you, here, put this on and go out here, and which, you know, Lawler's favorite team was always the Cleveland Browns, and he puts on this stuff like a Brown stuff during football season. They tell you they want you to be like, I think it was like Cowboy stuff or something like that, and put on that stuff and go out, and it was just like hood on and to work with him on TV, and which, I mean, you know, 17 years old, I don't care from 17 on till today, you know, I mean, I'll always have respect for Lawler, what he's done, the money that he's drawn, and what he's done for wrestling and all.
You know, I've noticed over the years you've worn a mask, you've wrestled in a mask a lot. Do you have a preference preferring to work in a mask or without one?
Yeah, oh, that's pretty cool. Everybody, most people I hear say, which it's, I mean, at what point you're at and what they need and everything, to me it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't really matter one way or the other. It's whatever's best for the time frame. Like, I mean, it's pretty good, which people have asked me about different things, a lot of stuff about Japan. I mean, you can get pretty good runs if you got two or three different characters. I mean, like the monster character, the Nightmare Freddy thing in Japan during the Monster series, we do that. Then see, and the funny thing where the Nightmare stuff, a lot of it come from in Continental. You was talking about watching Continental. You had the Nightmares. You had Ken Wayne and Danny Davis.
Yeah.
Well, at that time, I worked here in the USWA, or actually, yeah, it was USWA then. And I was getting ready to leave there to go down there, and my brother said, well, I want to put you in this gimmick in this deal with Ken Wayne and Danny Davis. And I said, okay, what do you want to do? He said, we won't call you like another Nightmare like they was before they come out from under the hoods, but we need some kind of gimmicky name. Well, this is the funny thing, which nobody's ever heard this. I've never even really said nobody, but my middle name's Fred. And Ken Wayne and them used to call me Fred. They'd say Freddy, and Ken said, oh, that'd just be Nightmare Freddy. And as a gimmick, and us just talking and laughing, Eddie said, well, let's just call him that then. And that's where the Nightmare Freddy thing come from in Continental.
Yeah, you know, I noticed I got, like, the last episode right because there was apparently a big shakeup, one week there was doing this interview where Paulie Dangerously is doing this interview bashing Eddie Gilbert, your brother, and you're under the mask, and they had acknowledged that y'all were related, but at one point Paulie Dangerously says something like how he wished he'd break his neck or something, and you get mad and walk off, and I thought that was like a nice little touch to add.
Yeah, it was, I mean, everything was going, but that's when, at that point, it's when I think Dusty had called and wanted Eddie to come back to work for Crockett, or actually I think that was right during the time when you could look through the years and see, but I think it was right during the time where Turner was fixing to buy Crockett, I think.
Yeah.
And when Eddie went back and the thing was set up, which what Dusty had told Eddie was he wanted him to come and he wanted to be like, he wanted to groom him to wind up like taking that job, which it wound up, I mean, Eddie stayed for some years, but, I mean, that part of it never happened. But, I mean, Eddie had a good run in WCW then and everything. And, I mean, that's from where you're talking about where everything kind of went off kilter right there.
Yeah, because I say you don't you could tell how much your brother was doing on the show because they did the next week, and I've never seen a promotion fall apart that much on the, like, as far as booking goes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it went from that to, I think, and this is no knock or nothing, but I think it went from Eddie doing it, like, to Ronnie West doing it, I think. And like I said, it's no knock on Ronnie. I'm just, if you've got talent and got your guys, and one thing I always say, Eddie, it seemed like he made the most out of his guys. Whether you would have called them top-notch stars or what, he would have made the best out of the least that he could have from, I mean, if he wasn't stocked rich with talent. That's and a lot of people can't do that. I mean, it's easy. I say it's easy. It's a lot easier to book a territory when you're overloaded with talent. You know what I'm saying? That has drawn money than going to one that doesn't have it. And you got to make those guys characters, and you got to make them be able to draw money.
Yeah, exactly, though. Because if you got a bunch of, if you're overloaded with talent, the shows are going to be a little bit good regardless of booking, just because,
right. Now, you might not like the angles and the storylines. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you might not, as far as booking wise, you might not.
Yeah.
If you got a boatload of talent, now if you don't know what you're doing booking, you might scratch your head and say, why is that going on for? But still, you'll have mostly good stuff because you've got everybody. What I'm saying, talent wise.
Yeah.
Is you've already got everybody over, pretty much, like, which, I mean, I didn't see at the start of, like, is when I was still in high school and stuff, of Eddie's run with Watts when he booked it, but I wound up leaving after I graduated from high school. I went down there and worked, and when I went there in the summers before I got out, I mean, man, you talking, which, I mean, what Vince wound up getting, it seemed like to me, like 60 or 70% of that, if you look back on your tapes and look at stuff, come from UWF, from Watts' Mid-South days. I mean, all it seemed like the top guys that wound up being Vince's top guys, it seemed like most of them come down there. And Eddie had all them, and I thought, man, what a crew. And that's when I was still, like, you know, a junior in high school, and I thought, look at these guys. And that's when all of them, you know, the South kind of was more of a smaller, I don't want to say a small guy territory, because all the big guys come through here, and all the guys went from here to New York and different places and everything. But when I went down there to Watts' territory, it was like a big guy place. I mean, everybody, like, I mean, Eddie was the smallest guy for sure, but I'm talking about the next smallest guy was like 6'3 or 4. It was like, I thought, damn, it's like giants down there.
Did you get to work for Watts City?
Oh, yeah. That's where I went right out of high school. When I was 18, I worked on Eddie put together, he called them the Jive Tones, Pez Wadler, which Pez was a good friend of mine, and Tiger Conway Jr., they called them the Jive Tones. And actually, it was going to be, Pez was going to be mine, and what was Mike's last name? The guy from, Mike George from Kansas City. Eddie wanted to put me, which Mike had called about a job, and Eddie said, I'm going to put you with Mike George, which Mike was a good old-school worker, and he wanted me to have a partner that I could work with and learn from and everything. And he put me with Mike, but Mike just stayed about a month and decided he'd rather be at home and went back home. So I wound up being Tiger Conway, wound up quitting. So I wound up putting, which Pez was my manager for a little bit, then wound up being my partner, and me and him was partners for a good while for Watts.
You know, after you left Continental, you ended up wrestling on pay-per-view against the Great Muta.
Yeah, I did the actual, I worked, like I said, Eddie went back and he worked in the office and done a lot of things, and I've done a lot of the tours, which they'd say A team and B team, but I mean, I worked on a lot of the North Carolina tours which different people had different thoughts about things or people that Eddie helped, anybody can say whatever, and Paul can say whatever, and I'm fine with whatever he says, but Eddie always kept Paul a job. I mean, he had, like, on the North Carolina runs, which when it got time for the Midnight Express, they wanted the Road Warriors to be heels. Well, they beat the Midnight Express, and they brought Eddie brought back in Dennis, and which I love Dennis. He's a great guy, Dennis Condrey, and Randy Rose, and put Paul with them and give him a job right there. Then, like on all the Charlotte and the South Carolina, North Carolina tours, they'd send them as far as the main event, and then a bunch of us underneath that. And, I mean, all that's very good, but then you'd have the Road Warriors and the Varsity Club over here in the northern cities, and all that would do good also, and you'd have Flair with them. And, like I said, usually on the top of our stuff was Midnight Against Midnight or something like that.
All right, let me ask you something, because I don't want to forget about this. I was going on YouTube last night, and I found this match. I don't know if you've seen it online, but it's you and doing the Nightmare Freddy gimmick, and Eddie is wearing a Michael Myers mask, and you're wrestling in Wing. And after the match is over, you get on the microphone, and Eddie does basically, you know, just kind of something cussing out the promoter, saying they weren't paying you enough.
Oh, no, it was never about not paying.
Or something like that.
I've seen people was put on the internet that I said something about money. No, it was never. I've had a great run in Japan through today, and, I mean, I was supposed to go back in September, October one, but it was never about the money. Right here is the thing, and I don't think I've ever even said this on any other show. I've said it to a couple of people that have asked me about it. But see, you remember hearing of Corporal Kirshner that wrestled in WWF?
Yeah.
Some years ago. Well, me and him was partners, and we was the tag team champs over there for a long time, and we went back and forth on a lot of tours together. Me and him was good friends. Well, the guy that wrestled on those tours as Jason, you know, under the Jason mask still. When Mike got in trouble over there, he hit a guy, and he wound up going to jail for like 6 or 8 months over there. He had to stay in jail. Well, that guy took his stuff, his wrestling gear and all of his stuff he had, and sold it to a wrestling, like, cafe, a wrestling store. Well, when the guy that done that, the office fired him. Well, this stayed going on like 8 months. The guy was gone, and all of a sudden, back on that tour that me and Eddie went on with the Moondogs, they decided they was going to bring him back, and they just told me the day of that show. And I said, well, no, y'all can't do that, because this guy's stole all of my friends' stuff and sold it. I said, you can't bring him back to work here. It'd make it look like everybody should do like that. And I said, and you know, as far as me and you sitting here talking, you wouldn't want nobody working for you that stole from you, right? Well, I said, look, either he could not work for this show, or either I'm done. And the owner laughed, which I said, look, dude, I'm not playing. Well, Victor Quinones was like a middleman in this. And he said, Doug, don't do nothing that you're going to regret. Well, I wasn't going to regret it, because I still to this day think what the guy did was wrong. And that's what that whole deal was about. It was about the guy selling Mike Kirshner's stuff, and I thought it was wrong. I thought it was wrong for them to let the guy come back and work for the company.
Okay, I was just wondering.
It was never about money, though. I mean, that's the first thing I want to say. I've seen people write that this guy said it was about money and that guy said it was about money. No, it was never about money. And, I mean, even after I'd done that, the next day I got paid what I was owed, and I got took to the airport and caught my flights, and all the guys did that was with me.
Okay, yeah, I wasn't sure if it was about money. It's just, you know, the tape I was watching is kind of a couple of generations old.
Yeah, well, I was looking at something old, and it was an article that somebody wrote, and they said that they had talked to Eddie something about it, and I think they said he said it could have been money, could have been involved, but, I mean, no, it was never. I would never go to Japan for except what I wanted to go for in the first place. And I mean, to me, guys should never wrestle here for except what they want to. Why would you want to leave your house? That's whether I'm going 30 minutes, 4 hours, whatever. If you're not happy before you leave, you're damn sure not going to be happy when you get there, when you get home. And that's kind of always been my logic on it.
I like that. That's actually a really good point. I'm going to have to remember that.
Well, I mean, think. What it's not going to get better. And, I mean, I'm not a free spender where I just blow money, but I'm going to get what I need. And if you can't spend some money, get what you need, and still make money, you don't need to do it.
Yeah.
The way I look at it. I like to live nice, and I'm going to, and I'm not going to work for you. And that's one thing for you to say, well, Doug thinks he's better than what he is. Anybody can say that, but you know what? If you don't want to use me, that's fine. But, I mean, I'm going to get what I want to wrestle. That's just, you know, it's, to me, that's the way. If everybody look at it that way, everybody would be a lot happier.
Yeah, no, I mean, I understand what you're saying, though, because, you know, you got to get yours, you know. It's like people try to, you know, people will try to say something like, you know, oh, well, they don't, you know, then don't use, you know,
well,
I,
oh,
I
you know what,
don't
what, what I've heard, well, I pay so-and-so this, or I pay so-and-so that, and I say, well, good, and it's no disrespect, it's no hard feelings, but when you do get the money, you can call me back, but you know, I'm not comparing myself to anybody else. I'm just telling you what I'll do something for. I mean, it's just like any other job. It's, I tell guys, well, just go down the street and get a guy at a gas station, get him to do it for that then. If, you know, if
yeah.
you think he can do it, get somebody else to do it. Don't call me, and it's me not meaning no disrespect or anything. It's just the way, I mean, whatever business you're in your life, that's, to me, the motto you should have. And, I mean, I want everybody to be happy. I mean, you know, if you can't do it now, that's cool. You can call me later, and if you can do it then, that's cool. And if not, I'll be all right, and you will too. That's just, I mean, I think that's all logic.
I was watching some, like I said, I was watching some matches, and I noticed you had some really good punches. How do you learn that?
You know, this is the thing, and this is from old school thing. He used to tell me, punch a block wall. I said, do what? And my dad and my brother, which, you know, my brother that went through it the years before me, said, before you ever even punch that block wall. Whenever you can punch a, like, you know, block, like as far as block building, like a wall. So whenever you can punch that, then you punch in the ring. But until you can do that, don't punch in the ring. What they was talking about was punches looking so shitty and everything that people did, which my dad's whole thing was, if you can't throw a good punch, throw a forearm. And the guys like my dad, they would work with you, but their working was, they'd ring your bell throwing forearms. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they couldn't, nobody say nothing
yeah.
about those wasn't right and everything. But, I mean, I've just watched different people punch. Now, there's dozens of different guys I thought was great. I mean, I've seen dozens and dozens of guys I thought was great. But like Dick Murdoch, I traveled with him a lot, like for Watts, and I used to think, you know, thought his punches was great. And then guys like, I mean, if people see Scott Hall now like he is right now, which I hope he gets better, but him in his prime, he was one of the great guys that punch-wise that I thought was great. And, I mean, there's just so many. I mean, you got to realize, I watched from when I was a kid, every guy that come through Memphis here that went on and done good as far as an AWA, WWF, all the different territories out West Texas, Dallas, I got to see a lot of good workers.
All right, now you have to be in the 96 Royal Rumble. How did that come about?
Well, it was, I'm going to be honest, I think at that time Vince and them was talent-wise, they were shorter than they had ever been as far as just in-house
yeah.
talent and everything. And they had working relationships with Lawler and Jarrett, because Lawler was up there with them, and Vince and Jarrett was always cool. And then I had working relationship with Cornette, which Cornette had Smoky Mountain at the time. So they done what they done was done like a Royal Rumble type battle royal deal at Memphis, and the one at Memphis I won, the one in Knoxville, Buddy Landell won. And what they was wanting to do, they was going to get like three different guys and add to their regular bus just to try to spice it up a little bit. And that's how I wound up being in that deal. I won the one in Memphis at the Coliseum, and that's what put me in their Royal Rumble deal.
How was that when you got there, exactly, how did they lay it out to you? Did they tell you exactly how long you were to be out there?
Well, right here,
tell you how it, you?
This is how it was supposed to be laid out. I was supposed to fly in a day before, and I was supposed to fly in on Saturday morning. Well, they sent me a ticket, and I got it. I changed my ticket to Sunday. I wrestled Saturday night in Nashville because at the time I thought, well, you know, I mean, the stuff that I was doing was more here, and I mean, it was programmed weekly from Memphis to Louisville to Evansville to Nashville, and you know, I mean, that's where I was booked at, was in Nashville that Saturday night. Well, my ticket was for that morning. Well, everybody else flew in. I didn't fly into the next morning. Well, that afternoon, after I was supposed to get there, Vince had a meeting with everybody. Well, I missed the meeting. And then when I got to the building, about 3 hours before the pay-per-view was fixing to start. Well, Vince and them had done gone out there. By the time I actually got to the building, I got to the airport about 3 hours before it was supposed to start. I probably got to the building about an hour and a half before it was supposed to start or something like that. I went, they told me, showed me a dressing room. It was a dressing room. It was myself, The Undertaker, and Bret Hart in it, which I knew Undertaker Mark from his years in USWA as Master of Pain. And I walked in, shook their hand, introduced myself, asked Mark how he was doing and everything. And then one of the agents walked in and told me, said, well, they got you going out, and it was whatever number it was. I went out and said, they want you to stay. Like, it was, I don't know, I think they told me like 6-8 minutes or something, but wound up being the thing where, which they was trying to get Vader over to town. They said, if you don't mind, Vader will pick you up, do one of the press things. And I said, well, I don't mind. But that was my, which I should have probably, if I, you know, would have thought business wise about it, I should have probably went the day before, like when they'd sent the ticket for. But to me, my thing was kind of more important here than it was for Vince, which I probably lost some money doing that. But I mean, we all do some stuff and all of us make some mistakes.
How was Vader to work with in that match? Was that the only time you ever worked with him?
I think that was the only time I actually worked with him. And it was like, I mean, I've heard everybody, different guys, gripe and complain, but the only thing you got to realize is that's the way most everything is in Japan. Like, all the guys that worked here and not Japan as much as I did, I mean, I've come more near just being used to the stuff because it was different guys on a lot of the Japan tours I was on from different companies and everything. Is for the, some of them was from the actual real shoot companies and everything, so it was just a lot of real steel stuff.
All right. One thing I'm curious about, because I remember I was watching the 2000 Royal Rumble with one of my nephews, and he asked me, I can't remember how it was, he asked me how they got paid, and I've got curious about, when you were in the match, did you end up getting a bonus like the regular wrestlers would get, like as far as a royalty bonus, or were you just paid for the night?
I was paid for the night, but I have got some checks since then, which, I mean, that's actually a pretty good deal. And like I said, for me not going in the day before, which business-wise, if you look back and everything, I mean, after that, Lawler told me, so why did you change your ticket for? And my answer was because I thought this down here was more important to me than that up there was. You know what I'm saying? He was looking at the big picture, and I'm glad and he's done well and everything. But, I mean, at the time, this was, you know, I worked every day here, and to me this was the big picture. So, I mean, you know, I mean, like I said, we all do some things that I guess we think we should have changed. But, I mean, I look back at it now, and I still wouldn't have did any different. I had a great run here, and I was at home, and, you know, I mean, guys can't ask for much more than that.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that, though, because that was like your regular job, you know. You have to look out for that over something that's just one night.
Right, but, I mean, I know the way Lawler was looked at was he was the one that him and Jarrett was the one that hooked me up and got me the deal, and, I mean, I should have really – I mean, between me and you and everybody listening, I should have business-wise, I should have went back then. But then I was such a young fella, I didn't care. I mean, I cared about that. I wanted that to do good and everything. But the most important thing to me at that point was this territory here in Memphis.
Okay, if I can go back a little bit to when you went to Global and you became the Dark Patriot.
Yeah.
How did that gimmick come about?
It come about by they was looking for somebody else to put against the to work a program with Dale Wilkes. They said they'd had different guys that they just kind of fed to him and different guys that he had beaten. They was wanting something. He was getting ready to be off for a while. I can't remember what the deal was, but I mean he had a deal to come up right after that in Japan that he had, and I think that's one of his things. But he wanted to be off for a few months, and Eddie had asked me, did I want to come and do something with him? And at the same time, Bruce Pritchard had just left working for Vince. And Eddie said, I'm going to put Bruce Pritchard with you, and he'd do the talking, and we'll put you under a hood and everything, and said, we'll do angle, and then we'll do some stuff with you after him. So I said, okay, which I knew would be well thought out. And I wound up having a good run there, which Joe Petticino, which is a great guy, and everything was there, and Eddie was his booker, and I mean, there's some other different guys there, but I mean, it was a good deal, which is the first time I'd ever really wrestled it in the Sportatorium, which I'd always heard everybody talk about it and how famous and great and different it was.
Yeah, I remember because I used to watch the. I remember watching the Global on ESPN when I was a kid, and I remember the Dark Patriot. I thought that was the coolest thing because like you never really saw an evil version of a good guy wrestler.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. At the time, it was something a little new. I mean, after that, you've seen it done quite a few other times, but I mean, at the time, it was something different when Eddie said to me. I thought, well, it sounds interesting. And I mean, the whole thing, if you can kind of bring some kind of life to the character and make it mean something, and if it stood out for you as a person, I mean, I've heard other people say, and like I said, I mean, it helps not only like as far as the monster stuff in Japan. I went over there in tag team tournaments with different guys as the Dark Patriot, and then I went for, I don't know, well, I've went ever since then as myself. Like I said, if you can't get a decent career out of two or three different pretty good gimmicks, I guess you can't get one. But anyway, I've done pretty well with them, and that was all, it was a nice time and everything.
All right, you were also in the really early ECW.
Oh, yeah, I was Eddie Broad, which I was with Eddie in that, and I mean, Eddie was one that, I mean, everybody, they think ECW, and they, you know, they, which the older ass fans, one that was with it from the start, remember actually when it did start. But then some of the people say, oh, when Paul Heyman started, that was the first of, no, that wasn't actually the first of, but like when, after it got started and Eddie got some top guys in and it was drawing good and everything, he's working with a lot of different guys. Like some of the guys, I brought like half of my Japanese office come over for like a couple of TV tapings. I don't know if you ever saw them, like Miguel Perez was on the Headhunters.
Yeah.
Masanaga, Mr. Danger, he was on. Another one of the young Japanese guys was on them. But, I mean, Eddie brought a lot of those guys over. And, I mean, it was good. It was something different, something fresh for that area up there.
And you held an ECW belt, but I can't remember which one. Was it the tag team title?
Yeah, me and Eddie was the tag champs.
Okay. Now, if you don't mind me asking, what happened there? Because I've heard, you know, you hear rumors over the years about what happened, how Paul Heyman took over.
Well, it was Jim Crockett. This was a funny thing. Jim Crockett come into the situation, and Todd Gordon was the owner, and, I mean, he'll have his version of it, I'm sure, also. But what was supposedly going to happen was Jim Crockett was supposedly going to put money in on it, and that was a way that Paul had, I think, had kind of figured out how to kind of get a little bit in on it. But, I mean, Eddie was never against Paul or nothing. I mean, just when Eddie finally told him, he told him if they was going to do more stuff, I think he wanted a raise, and as far as he was under guarantee per week and everything, and it was how many shows they were supposed to do, and they was wanting to do more shows, and he told him if he'd done that and booked, it was going to be X amount of dollars. And then when Crockett come in, I mean, it's like, this is what you think. You know, I mean, if you had been the top guy in the wrestling business and you had blown that business away, I wouldn't think you'd want that same guy to come in your company if you had a company now.
No.
And if he'd done blowed his to crap, I don't think that would be the guy that you would pick to come into your company and start helping you, right? And that's what Eddie's point was. And, I mean, that wound up being Eddie's way out. He just said, the heck with it. Y'all do what you want with it.
Now, you've been in a lot of hardcore top matches over the years. Was there ever any chance you would have came into ECW later?
No, I think pretty much when I left that night, which Eddie come in, I worked this one show after Eddie. Eddie come in and done a promo the last show I worked, and I thought, and you look back now, it was everybody just having to do what they needed to do at the time. I thought they was a little bit disrespectful to Eddie, but I mean, the one good thing about, I mean, Philadelphia and everything, I mean, everybody there has thought that they're smarter than, you know, I mean, you hear people say smart marks or smart wrestling fans or whatever, but they all thought they were smart way before, you know, I mean, way before their time as far as they wanted to have the inside and what everybody was doing, and they all pretty much knew Eddie was the booker and what was going on and this and that. So it was kind of, like I said, everybody just had to do their own thing, and I knew it wouldn't have never been a right time for me to went back. Like, I went back for the NWA, and for one of the best promoters I think I ever worked for, Dennis Corleone, I worked up there for him, but I never went back for ECW.
And also, you know, around this time you started teaming up with Tommy Rich regularly.
Yeah, me and Tommy had a good run in the early 90s, and actually through the mid-90s and everything, and I mean, I was in a couple of the, well, I mean, I'm sure there was other with different people, good angles, great angles, but a couple of the last really good angles, I think, as far as the USWA had, and one of them was with me and Tommy against PG-13. It lasted about a year and a half, which you didn't ever hear of that at that time lasting for anything like that, and one of them with Brian Christopher that lasted about a year or so. So, I mean, that was a good run. Good run through the 90s, and, I mean, like I said, up to the day, knock on wood, I've done pretty well.
What do you think is the best match you've ever had?
I'm gonna tell you, I'm gonna tell you that two of the guys that don't get enough credit. The two of the guys that helped me the most, as far as I had good matches with, because they were so good. It was when I was young, is with Jerry Stubbs, which was Mr. Olympia in the '80s and around there in the '80s for Watts and in Florida and everywhere. And him and have you ever seen Jerry Stubbs wrestle?
I saw him once or twice. You know, I think I saw him once on this old Mid-South episode.
Yeah, he was really great. And another guy that Eddie booked me with a lot, and me and Piz Wadley worked against Brad Armstrong and Tim Horn, which Brad Armstrong is one of the best guys that I ever worked against. I mean, he is freaking great. But I'm always, I guess, kind of partial to the matches I had with Eddie. I thought I had some good matches with my brother. And, I mean, Eddie really always worked hard. But, I mean, there was a lot of different people, I mean, in a lot of different times. I don't know that there's any one certain one, but, I mean, I had to always be on my toes with my brother. And, like I said, all the other guys, like I said, when I started in the business, it seemed like they was all great workers. I mean, now, since that time, I've seen it slide a little bit, but you know what I'm saying there.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. I think it's just not as much promotions out there, so, you know, it just kind of leads to a rot.
Right. Well, I mean, it's the only thing you got to realize, when you got a promotion in every little town, you're not going to get top notch talent everywhere. You know what I'm saying? And that's not putting nobody down. I mean, I wish everybody the best and want everybody to get better. But you can't have. It's like if you got enough guys for two good promotions and you got like 200 good promotions. That's what it's wound up got to these days.
Okay, let me, if you don't want to talk about this, this is fine. Could I ask you about what happened in 99 with Power Pro?
Yeah, I mean, it was just a difference of, we had a difference. Everybody's got, like you said, as far as booking goes, everybody's got a different idea or a way things should be, and their idea and mine went awry there, and I'd been in Japan for about 3 weeks or so and come back, and as soon as I get back, my cell phone starts blowing up. And like I said, we had my idea of heat and yours could be different, but the only thing when you do promos and stuff, it's good to make things personal, but it's bad to make things too personal. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's bad to make people say, this is so personal, or it's so bad that I don't even want to watch it. Now I'm going to buy a ticket, watch somebody do something, but I don't even care about watching it because they've done one a little bit too far. And that's what I thought, and at the time I probably just needed a break. And I've told people this before. A lot of it I was probably wrong, but I think a little bit they might have been wrong. But, I mean, you know, we all have breaking points, and at that point you probably do something that you wish you hadn't had later, but – I mean, you got to do what you got to do.
No, I mean, I understand what you're saying, though, because I know I've watched stuff on TV sometimes there, and, you know, you'll hear something, and I remember there'll be times I'll just turn the channel because it's like, you know, there ain't nothing going to pay that off because, you know, like, you know,
well, no,
you say,
that's
so
what I'm
personal.
Saying. If it disgusts you, you do not want to keep watching it. That's, I mean, that's you, that's me. And now, it's got to be pretty bad for me or different wrestling people because we've seen so much since we, like I said, since I was a kid and have grown up in the wrestling business. But it's you got to think, and I just thought, and I told the funny thing, I didn't even say nothing to Tommy about it till we went on TV. Then after the interview, I told him, I said, well, I can go home now. Guess I can take a break and rest up. But I've been in Japan for 3 weeks, and I didn't really, you know, I mean, it was just one of them deals where what come out and what was said. It ain't, you know, back then it wasn't no scripted. You kind of got what you got. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we come up with our own interviews, and if they drew money, that was good for us because, I mean, we drew money, we made more money.
What was Tommy's reaction to it after you went there? Was he angry or did he understand?
Tommy was always cool. Me and Tommy, up to this day, I still talk to Tommy every couple of days. I mean, he's a good guy. You should have on your show sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to him.
Tommy understood. The thing about my dad, Tommy started with my dad, and then him and Eddie was partners, then me and him was partners. So he's kind of been kind of like part of the family and everything. And Tommy's a great guy, and, I mean, he's got a million different stories he could tell you and everything. But, I mean, he understood. He knew, I mean, if I said something, it took a lot to make me say more than I should. So he knew I took what I wanted and I said what I thought. I mean, you know, sometimes everybody said, well, it was a rebel or outlaw. I don't know what it is. If you speak your mind, if it makes you be something, then that's sometimes what we got to be.
Yeah, no, I understand. And I was, you know, I was hesitant to ask about it, but after talking to you, you know, you seem pretty cool, so I just wanted to ask about it real quick.
No, that's fine. I've got no problem. Like I said, a lot of that stuff, you look back, and I probably should have handled it different. I've handled a lot of stuff, like as far as the, don't, you know, nobody in their right mind changes if Ben sends you a ticket, changes it, and I did. So what's that say? I must not have been in my right mind, or I didn't care. I wasn't in my right mind. I didn't really care about that product. I cared about more about what I was doing, and I thought that was the right thing to do at the time. You know, like I said, and you look back at it, it probably wasn't. But who do you know that Vince them sends tickets to and they change them? I mean, unless you're one of their top guys or just one of their boys, you don't do that, which I didn't really care. And like I said, I mean, knock on wood, I don't think I'd change things too awful much. If I'd have done it, I might have made a lot more money, and I might say I would if I knew that, but I don't, you know, that's not, I've done fine.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, though, because sometimes, you know, but you got to, something, you know, I know I've made mistakes before, you know, and I just think, you know, I did what I thought was best with the knowledge I had at the time.
Right. Well, I mean, Jerry Jarrett tried to get me one time to go on when he was in Vince's office. He said, I'm going to come up with your gimmick, and he said it's going to be somewhat similar to the Honky Tonk Man gimmick. He said, but they're going to the Middle East for 3 weeks. He said, and I've told Vince I want you to go and want to put you in the gimmick, and I want to do it over there, and you get it honed in, and when you come back, you do it then. And it was right at the time, like the last week of it was supposed to be a trip when I was supposed to go to Japan. And I told Jerry, I said, Jerry, I'm supposed to go to Japan at the end of this. And he said, well, no, you need to stay and do this whole tour to show him that you want to work. Well, I told him no, because at that time, Japan was my guaranteed money, and I'd never had a problem and never have had a problem out of them about money or anything. So I wound up not going. And now most people would have, in a second, would have went on the tour, right? But I just stuck with Japan and held out for what I had, which, I mean, you got to, you know, like you said, you got to do what you think is best for you, and that's what I've always tried to do. Like I said, I've made a few mistakes. I know that.
You know, they're about to cut us off because they only give us about 45 minutes. I want to thank you very much for doing the show. This has been a great talk. I really appreciate it.
Good deal, Doc. You have a good day, and I hope everybody listens, had a good time listening to us.
All right, man. You have a good night.
You too, C-Man.
All right, bye.